This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. Welcome to Science Journal, an audio journal production presenting articles of interest from science magazines, newspapers, and online resources on topics such as technology, health, and the environment. Material is selected with the interests of its audience in mind and with the goal to inform and entertain. The opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of Audio Journal, its board of directors, staff, or volunteer readers. This program is supported in part by Cognex and UMass Chan Medical School. Our program today will bring you articles from a variety of sources, including the New York Times Science Section, The New Yorker, The Smithsonian, the online New Scientist, and Science Daily. This is Tricia Droney, and I will start today with an article from the New York Times entitled "Hantavirus Doesn't Spread Easily, But Officials May Be Downplaying Risks." This is written by Apoorva Mandavilli on May 14, 2026. Close, sustained contact. That, officials have repeatedly said, is the only way that the Andes hantavirus, which caused an outbreak on a cruise ship and has gripped the world's attention, spreads among people. You have to be in close contact with someone who has a lot of symptoms, Dr. J. Bhattacharya, acting director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, said in an interview on Fox News. But scientists who have studied hantavirus for decades are far less certain about how the virus might behave. They agree with health officials that the Andes virus is not particularly contagious and is unlikely to spur a bigger outbreak. But they said research has shown that under certain circumstances, the virus can be transmitted without direct contact. It's important to be honest scientifically and communicate that, because otherwise you lose credibility, said Stephen Bradfute, a viral immunologist and hantavirus expert at the University of New Mexico. In an interview, Dr. Tedros Ghebreyesus, Director General of the World Health Organization, acknowledged that officials have emphasized close contact as the way the virus spreads to avoid panicking people over rarer possibilities. It's very difficult to explain to people saying, okay, this is the exception, this is the norm, he said. When you say the exception, they might still think that that's something frequently happening as well. The hantavirus outbreak that began on the Dutch cruise ship MV Hondius last month has thus far sickened at least 9 people and killed 3. Many of the roughly 150 passengers, including 18 in the United States, are being closely monitored in quarantine. The remaining were given a set of instructions to avoid spreading the virus to others, including take your temperature daily, don't fly commercial, and try to use your own bathroom. On CNN's State of the Union on Sunday, Dr. Bhattacharya could not recall when some passengers who disembarked on April 24th in St. Helena, an island in the Atlantic Ocean, had arrived on American soil. None had symptoms at the time of their travel, he said, so officials had not seen a need to alert the public or trace contacts. The virus doesn't spread unless someone has active symptoms, he said. That, too, is not certain, although some scientists believe people may be most contagious just as they are developing symptoms. Some labs have studied hantaviruses for decades, but there is still much that's not known about them because they grow slowly and are difficult to analyze genetically. Hantaviruses are naturally found in rodents. The Andes virus, found primarily in Argentina, where the cruise ship began its journey, is the only hantavirus species known to spread among people. But scientists were slow to acknowledge that possibility. It was very difficult to convince people of that, even here in Argentina, said Valeria Martinez, a virologist at the National Institute of Infectious Diseases in Buenos Aires. In the largest outbreak characterized so far in Epien, Argentina, Dr. Martinez and her colleagues carefully traced transmission patterns among 34 cases and 11 deaths between November 2018 and February 2019. The study confirmed that the virus does not spread easily. None of 82 health workers who cared for patients became infected, even though many of them did not wear protective gear. But the researchers also identified what they called super spreading events, in which a single person spread the virus to several others. The outbreak began after a man who became infected from rodents developed a fever and attended a birthday party with 100 guests. He was there only 90 minutes because he was feeling ill, Dr. Martinez said. Within 3 weeks of the event, five people at the party had become ill. One of those five soon died, and his wife most likely passed the virus to another 10 people at his wake. In all, six of 34 cases in the outbreak had no direct contact with those who were ill, and one seems to have become infected after simply saying hello as they crossed paths. That's not close contact, and it's also not prolonged contact, said Joseph Allen, director of the Healthy Buildings Program at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. Studies so far suggest that the disease is most contagious when people are carrying a lot of virus, perhaps just as they are starting to feel sick. But there have also been too few outbreaks large enough to be sure of that. We have so little data that it's really hard to say anything concrete or definitive, said Kartik Chandran, a virologist at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine. Still, the fact that there have been very few cases should in and of itself reassure people that the virus is not very contagious, he and other experts said. After weeks of being cloistered together on the ship, only 11 of the roughly 150 passengers became infected, Dr. Tedros noted. You can see how the virus actually is not really as efficient as COVID. One person in the Argentina outbreak became ill after sharing a hospital room with a hantavirus patient, but again, had no physical contact. Hantavirus typically infects people when they breathe in virus particles aerosolized from rodent droppings. That fact, some experts believe, leaves open the possibility that person-to-person transmission could possibly occur through the air, too. I don't understand why we are so reluctant to acknowledge the inhalation route when we're talking about person-to-person transmission, said Lindsay Marr, an expert in airborne transport of viruses at Virginia Tech. Airborne transmission is certainly the simplest explanation in those cases, she said of the Argentinians who had no direct contact with patients. Dr. Tedros of the WHO said his organization had not referred to the findings about the birthday party spread because they had not been replicated by other studies and because close contact is the most common way the virus spreads. But Gustavo Palacios, a virologist at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai and an author on the paper, disagreed with that stance. Our paper is important because it helps define the outer boundary of what Andes virus can do under favorable transmission conditions, he said. Most events will not look like that, but public health guidance still has to account for that possibility. In the United States, the CDC did not issue any guidance or statements on the hantavirus outbreak until late on Friday and did not hold a news briefing till Saturday, nearly 1 month after the first passenger died. It still describes transmission as requiring close or intimate contact. The CDC appears to have designated an arbitrary measure of closeness, acknowledging the threshold as not absolute. It has cited being at a distance of less than 6 feet for longer than 15 minutes out of the COVID playbook as an indication of risk. In public, some U.S. health officials have shown uncertain command of the facts of the current outbreak. Speaking about the first two people who died from the virus on the Fox News interview, Dr. Bhattacharya incorrectly said the couple had been in their 80s. They were 70 and 69, and added, people who were very close to them, the roommates, a doctor who was caring for them, they're the ones who got symptomatic. He was wrong about the details. CDC scientists were not on the ship to investigate the outbreak, but WHO officials who led the investigation are still working out how other passengers became infected. The third person who died, an 80-year-old German woman, was not a roommate of the first two or even on the same deck. But she may have shared meals or been in other spaces with them, said Dr. Maria van Kerkhove, the WHO's Director of Epidemic and Pandemic Preparedness. Andrew Nixon, a spokesman for the Department of Health and Human Services, which oversees the CDC, said federal agencies have been fully engaged from the outset. He did not respond to questions about the scientific basis for the six-foot guidance or about Dr. Bhattacharya's errors. Attempts to second-guess this response overlook the ongoing work being done to protect the health and well-being of American citizens, he said. The WHO does not include the six-foot distance in its guidance, and its description of the outbreak acknowledges the scarcity of data, including on transmission. We are learning, and we will continue to learn, I think, for quite some time, Dr. van Kerkhove said. The book is not written. Next up, an article written on May 19th by Jordan Kistner, entitled, At a Los Angeles Museum, Giving New Life to Dead Animals. At 11, Tim Bovard undertook his first taxidermy experiment on a piece of roadkill. He had found an unlucky skunk and improvised its reanimation using an instruction book, much to the alarm of his friend's parents. His own parents were unfazed. His father and grandfather were both scientists and outdoorsmen, and soon it was known in their suburban community of Claremont, California, that, as Bovard recently recounted, Dr. Bovard's son was an animal nut. So when they found the abandoned birds, owls, hawks, kestrels, crows, blue jays, scrub jays, they brought them to me, and I raised them. By the time he was a teenager, he was sewing his own clothes, learning to tan leather, and taking backpacking trips in the Sierras with his dogs while wearing a full buckskin suit of his own creation. He began apprenticing with a local taxidermist in high school and then chose to work for him full-time when his peers left for college. He later did get a degree in zoology. Bovard was always set on his life path, though when he visited friends at college parties, he asked them to stop mentioning what he did instead of going to class, noticing that it gave some people the creeps. Bovard, still exuberant and energetic at 72, is the last full-time taxidermist at any museum in the United States. He still lives in Claremont, now with his wife, two dogs, and 10 and a half cats. The half-cat lives mostly outdoors, and arrives at the Natural History Museum of Los Angeles County, where he has worked since 1984 at 4:30 a.m. He is responsible for maintaining animal mounts the museum has kept in its collection for more than a century, reworking dioramas that could look more true to life and designing new exhibits. In past generations, museums dispatched hunting expeditions to acquire their animal collections, but Bovard works only with donations from zoos or offerings from private collections. As when he was a child, roadkill is another option. Once the skin is on, he sews the pelt together, hiding his seams. Mammal stitching has to be pretty tight, he said, especially for lions or zebras. Now, a bear with long hair, it doesn't matter so much. For birds, feathers cover it all. The care and keeping of these forms is a responsibility he takes both seriously and joyfully. Frequently, he skips his commute entirely and sleeps in his office, rolling out a blanket between filing cabinets that carry the records of every animal in the museum's 111-year-old collection and the flushing wheel he uses to gently remove tissue from hides. It wouldn't be for everybody, he said with a smile, but I am known to be slightly different. That's putting it sort of mildly. In fact, he has slept at work for weeks at a time, like when he was revamping the museum's lion diorama and wanted to adjust furry skin folds and feline facial expressions every few hours during the night as the glue set. Unlike many taxidermists, Bovard is responsible not only for the animals on display in the museum, but also for every element of the dioramas, including every tree, leaf, twig, flower, dusting of snow, and body of water. He's made hundreds of thousands of leaves through a method called vacuum forming, a manufacturing technique where plastic is heated and then shaped around a mold using suction. Using leaf molds he created himself from plant matter he harvested on research trips. To do this exacting work, he has amassed an encyclopedic knowledge of the natural world. He knows, for example, that one key to designing a lifelike raptor is the hooding over the eyes. But he also knows the posture that raptor would take sitting on a tree branch, what kind of tree it would be sitting in, and patterns in which it would have preened its feathers, what kind of prey it might be looking for, and how its presence would most likely affect the behavior of every other animal in its radius. For a restaging of a lion family, he wanted two lionesses to be nuzzling foreheads, the standard greeting in big cats, to capture their sociality. He wanted to create more of a sense of dynamic movement in the scene of jaguars perched atop a box canyon in Sonora, Mexico, for example, by adding some small mammal prey, like javelinas, leaping away from the cats. "It's all about directing the eye," he said, pointing toward the far corner of the painted background. "And then there are the routine tasks, the things he'll never stop doing, at least not until he retires, like dusting the museum's pride of lions, vacuuming elephant ears, and polishing all the glass eyes." When asked about whether retirement is on the horizon, he laughed. He was still sleeping on his office floor as recently as New Year's. There's an orangutan he wants to mount this year and tens of thousands of more leaves to make. Nope, no plans to retire. Christine Jewett of The Washington Post wrote on May 5th, 2026, the following article entitled "FDA Blocked Publication of Research Finding COVID and Shingles Vaccines Were Safe." Officials at the Food and Drug Administration have blocked publication of several studies supporting the safety of widely used vaccines against COVID-19 and shingles in recent months, a spokesman for the Department of Health and Human Services confirmed. The studies, which cost millions of dollars in public funds, were conducted by scientists at the agency who worked with the data firms to analyze millions of patient records. They found serious side effects to be very rare. In October, the scientists were directed to withdraw two COVID-19 vaccine studies that had been accepted for publication in medical journals. In February, top FDA officials did not sign off on submitting abstracts about studies of Shingrix, a shingles vaccine, to a major drug safety conference. The withdrawal of the studies is the latest step by the administration to try to limit access to vaccines. It has sharply cut research funding for vaccine development, released unvetted information casting doubt on vaccines, and blocked other information supporting their safety, most recently a paper on COVID vaccine effectiveness by career scientists from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Asked about the withdrawal of the COVID vaccine safety studies, Andrew Nixon, a spokesman for the Department of Health and Human Services, said in an email, "The studies were withdrawn because the authors drew broad conclusions that were not supported by the underlying data. The FDA acted to protect the integrity of its scientific process and ensure that any work associated with the agency meets its high standards." Of the shingles studies that found that the vaccine to be effective, he said, "The design of that study fell outside the agency's purview." He did not address a question about the Shingrix safety study, which found the vaccine to be safe. A senior administration official said the decisions about the research had not reached Dr. Marty Makary, the FDA commissioner, or Health Secretary Robert Kennedy. Dr. J. Vinay Prasad was the head of the FDA vaccine office at the time. Dr. Prasad, who recently left the agency, did not respond to a request for comment. Last June, Mr. Kennedy's office asked career CDC staff members to delete from the agency's website A 17-page summary supporting the safety of thimerosal, an additive largely removed from vaccine 25 years ago. Career scientists were later called into Health and Human Services legal offices and grilled about how the summary had been posted in the first place, they previously told the New York Times. In posts on a website and on social media in August, Mr. Kennedy called for a prominent journal to immediately retract a large Danish study, concluding that the vaccine additive aluminum salts was safe. Dr. Christine Lane, the editor-in-chief of the journal, Annals of Internal Medicine, said Mr. Kennedy did not directly contact the journal seeking a retraction. The study was not retracted. In recent weeks, Dr. Jay Bhattacharya, who was serving as interim leader of the CDC, canceled the publication of a report concluding that the COVID vaccines sharply cut the odds of hospitalizations and emergency room visits last winter, saying the study had limitations. At a moment when public trust in institutions like the CDC is fragile, we cannot afford to lower our standards, Dr. Bhattacharya wrote in an editorial about news coverage of his decision. Dr. Aaron Kesselheim, a Harvard University medical professor who studies FDA regulation, said he had worked with the agency on a number of research papers and found its work to meet the highest standards of scientific investigation. He suggested that the request to pull the paper was an act of censorship. He added, at any other time in history, this would be a major scandal that would lead to congressional hearings and resignations of leadership. And I hope that's exactly what happens next. The withdrawn FDA studies examined the safety of the COVID vaccines used in 2023 and 24. The agency's scientists work with outside data firms that compile and analyze massive data sets under contracts that cost taxpayers millions of dollars each year. Both studies saw some light of day before they were pulled from publication. One, which examined the COVID vaccine in people older than 65, was posted on a preprint server, which is a repository for studies that have not yet undergone peer review. The study reviewed the records of about 7.5 million Medicare beneficiaries who got the vaccine. The researchers focused on the period of about 21 days after they got the vaccine and compared it to the next 20 days. They were looking to see if there were more health problems in the period right after vaccination. The study looked at 14 health outcomes potentially caused by the vaccine, including heart attacks, strokes, and Guillain-Barré syndrome, an autoimmune condition sometimes associated with vaccines. They only found a concern with one outcome, anaphylaxis, a severe allergic reaction affecting about 1 in 1 million people from the Pfizer vaccine. No other statistically significant elevations in risk were observed, the study said. The study was withdrawn after it had been accepted by the peer-reviewed journal Drug Safety, according to people familiar with the work. Michael Stacey, a spokesman for the journal, said it deemed submissions to be confidential and would not comment on them. The Times obtained a copy of the COVID vaccine safety study of people who were 6 months to 64 years old. An abstract of the study appeared at one conference and remains online. Its withdrawal was first reported by Stat News. That study examined the records of 4.2 million COVID vaccine recipients and examined their later experience with 17 conditions, including swelling of the brain, major blood clots, stroke, and heart attacks. The study found rare cases of fever-related seizures and myocarditis, or inflammation of the heart muscle, known to be associated with COVID vaccines. Given the available evidence, FDA continues to conclude the benefits of vaccination outweigh the risks, the study said. Angela Rasmussen, an editor-in-chief of the journal Vaccine, said the paper had been withdrawn by the authors. Dr. Caleb Alexander, a drug safety and methodology expert at Johns Hopkins University, reviewed both studies at the request of the Times and said that no study answers every question, but there is nothing inherently problematic regarding these reports. It's too bad that these haven't seen the full light of day, Dr. Alexander said in an email. They provide useful information regarding the most commonly used COVID-19 vaccines. Jeffrey Morris, director of the University of Pennsylvania Biostatistics Division, who also reviewed the study drafts at the request of the Times, said the studies were generally well done. I think if there's any critique, he said, is that they don't do enough of these studies with the resources they have. Dr. Jean Mazzaro, a former high-ranking National Institute of Health official and chief executive of the Infectious Disease Society of America, said that FDA leaders withdrawing papers from publication is a pretty active act of sabotage. This black box of decision-making around data suppression should be having people very alarmed and very worried, said Dr. Mazzaro. She filed a whistleblower complaint against the NIH, was fired by Mr. Kennedy, and has since sued the agency, claiming that she was ousted for objecting to its policies. By contrast, Mr. Kennedy's team had had lower standards for releasing information critical of vaccines. A memo by Dr. Prasad, the former head of the FDA's vaccine division, drew widespread news coverage by claiming that the COVID vaccine had been linked to the deaths of 10 children, a conclusion the agency has not backed up or explained. In February, agency officials did not sign off in time for staff to submit abstracts on two studies of the Shingrix vaccine to a drug safety conference, according to two people familiar with the decision. A senior administration official said the studies were not moving forward at the agency. One study found the efficacy to be in line with findings from the clinical trials done before agency approval. A safety study also aligned with what was known, finding an elevated but low risk for Guillain-Barré syndrome, an autoimmune disease already noted in the vaccine's label. Dr. Helen Chu, an infectious disease doctor, who was among 17 scientists fired from an influential vaccine advisory body at the CDC last summer, said large studies by health agencies are closely watched by doctors and professional societies. They are important, she said, because they can examine the effect of a vaccine on millions of people, far more than the thousands that were tracked in clinical trials. You really do need these studies for us to truly be safe and to make sure that vaccines continue to be safe, she said. These types of studies have to be done and the results have to be published. Next up from the New York Times is an article written in February of 2026 by Ellen Berry entitled, Research Finds Interaction with Father, Not Mother, Affects Child Health. For much of the 20th century and beyond, social scientists attributed a range of chronic mental health problems to dysfunction between infants and their mothers, who were categorized as overbearing, rejecting, domineering, or ambivalent. But a team of researchers from Pennsylvania State University has found that at times the early parenting behavior of fathers may have a greater impact on children's health. For a study published recently in the journal Health Psychology, the scientists observed three-way interactions between 10-month-old infants, their fathers, and their mothers, and then checked in on the families when the children were 2 and 7. They found that fathers who were less attentive to their 10-month-olds were likely to have trouble co-parenting, instead withdrawing or competing with mothers for the children's attention. And at age 7, the children of those fathers were more likely to have markers of poor heart or metabolic health, such as inflammation and high blood sugar. Mothers' behavior did not have the same effect, said Alp Atugla, a postdoctoral scholar at Penn State's College of Health and Human Development and an author of the paper. We, of course, expected that family dynamics, everybody in the family, fathers and mothers, would impact child development. But it was only fathers in this case, Dr. Ayatugla said. When the father's behavior in three-way interactions is negative, he said, then we start seeing how that negativity potentially bleeds over the family and eventually impacts child health. There is abundant research showing that children raised in high-stress households are at greater risk for health problems like obesity, and diabetes, and premature mortality later in life. Researchers can track stress levels by measuring markers of inflammation, which activate the immune system in the face of adversity or depression, or blood glucose levels, because humans evolved to generate energy when facing danger. But prior research has tended to focus on the parenting style of a single parent, typically the mother. To better understand whole family dynamics, the Penn State team examined 18-minute videotaped interactions of mothers, fathers, and their children at play at two points in time, assigning scores for parent sensitivity and positive effect, and for co-parenting dynamics like withdrawal and competitiveness. These behaviors sometimes arose when the father tried to divert the child's attention from the mother. Dr. Ayatugla said, "You may not gain the child's attention, and that could make you withdraw," he said. "Mostly men, compared to moms, can easily withdraw when they see they are not winning." Then, when children were 7 years old, the researchers took blood samples from their fingers to measure four inflammatory and metabolic markers. Two small to moderate associations emerged in the data. Fathers who engaged more sensitively with their babies were better at co-parenting, and the children whose parents more easily co-parented had lower levels of C-reactive protein, or CRP, and glycated hemoglobin, or HbA1c. These markers affect health over a long period of time, suggesting the children may be at higher risk for chronic disease in middle age or later. "This does not mean that only the dads matter, not the moms," said Hannah Scharrer, an associate professor of biobehavioral health at Penn State and an author of the paper. "Instead," Dr. Scharrer said, "it suggests that positive engagement by fathers during infancy and toddlerhood improves the health of the whole family." To explain this result, the authors laid out what they call the father vulnerability hypothesis, which suggests that fathers are particularly emotionally reactive to strain between parents and may behave in ways that negatively affect the whole family. "The father's role," they wrote, "may thus uniquely position him as a channel for relational stress, ultimately shaping child health." Another explanation, they wrote, is that the children spent more one-on-one time with their mothers and so were more sensitive to their father's behavior when they were in a group. Family leave programs might address that imbalance by allowing both parents to spend time with their children while they are very young, Dr. Ayatugla said. "It's kind of a missed chance for that parent who has to go and make money," he said. Greg Miller, a professor of psychology at Northwestern University, who studies how stress affects health, said previous studies haven't looked at fathers very often at all, because researchers typically ask only one parent to accompany the child for testing, generally the mother. This reflects a long-standing assumption in North America psychology that mothers are the most instrumental in shaping kids' well-being, said Dr. Miller, who was not involved in the study. "We don't know what role fathers play because we haven't studied them." Parenting behavior, he said, is just one of the many factors that shape a person's health in adulthood, alongside things like nutrition and physical activity. "Parents," he said, "can shape the way we engage with the social world, the way we engage with challenges and stress." Researchers will have to see if the results can be replicated, he said. "It's one study, so we are all asking questions, but it is certainly a tantalizing lead," he said. Sarah Sullivan, a professor of psychology at Ohio State University, who was not involved in the study, cautioned that the study was correlational, so it did not establish that the parenting behavior caused the child's health effects. For example, she said, "Some families may share genetic factors predisposing them to stressful family relationships and heart problems." "People tend to jump to conclusions about cause and effect," she said. "There is a risk of overinterpreting this." She noted that the subjects of the study, first-time parents who were recruited from childbirth education programs in Delaware, Maryland, Pennsylvania, and Texas, were mostly white, two-parent, middle-class families, making it difficult to generalize the results to a diverse population. Nevertheless, she described studying family dynamics over time as notoriously difficult, calling it impressive to find any statistically significant association between parental behavior in infancy and physical health at age 7. Our next article by Alexander Nazarian is entitled, Military Bases Are Rife with Forever Chemicals. New Mexico Wants Them Cleaned Up. Two men walked through livestock pens with a .22 caliber rifles, killing Art Schaap's cows. One man would raise his rifle, its barrel inches from a cow's forehead. A shot would ring out, the cow would fall, and the men would move on to the next cow. There were 3,665 cows at the Highland Dairy in Clovis, New Mexico, a city in the flatlands near the Texas border. After 6 hours of gunfire, there were none. Mr. Schaap felt he had no choice but to have his herd killed. Testing showed that the water he had pulled from wells on his property contained exceptionally high levels of PFAS, also known as forever chemicals, which have been linked to birth defects, liver and heart disease, and some cancers. State and federal regulators pulled his permit to sell milk and quarantined his herd. Selling his cows for beef was out of the question. "I don't want this farm no more," Mr. Schaap said. The source of the contamination, state environmental officials say, was his next-door neighbor, the Cannon Air Force Base, home to the 27th Special Operations Wing. For years, firefighters there had conducted exercises using a foam that contained PFAS. Runoff had seeped into the aquifer where Mr. Schaap and other farmers and ranchers drew their water. Similar scenarios have played out at hundreds of military facilities across the United States. But New Mexico has become the center of the nation's reckoning with PFAS. The state is suing the federal government for turning bases like Cannon into epicenters of forever chemical contamination. Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham has led this campaign. Weeks after she became governor in 2019, her administration filed suit against the U.S. Air Force over the PFAS pollution at Cannon. Because the accusations in New Mexico are so clear-cut, a federal judge in South Carolina picked New Mexico's suit to be a bellwether for similar litigation nationwide. The designation means the outcome of the New Mexico case will become an important benchmark in how the more than 15,000 similar PFAS suits nationwide are treated in court. Lawsuits filed on behalf of people like Mr. Schaap, who claim harm from forever chemicals in firefighting foam. It was a very clean-cut case, said Zachary Ogaz, the general counsel for the New Mexico Environment Department. It's pretty darn obvious where the PFAS is coming from. That, he said, will allow the court to explore the issue at the heart of the case. Who should be held accountable for the human, economic, and environmental cost of PFAS contamination? New Mexico's legacy of military pollution dates to World War II, when the effort to build an atomic weapon, the Manhattan Project, was based there. Radioactive elements last a long time. So do bitter memories. Ms. Lujan Grisham was born in Los Alamos, the nerve center of the Manhattan Project. Her sister Kimberly was diagnosed with brain cancer when she was age 2. Her parents believed the illness was linked to nuclear research. I can remember being in grade school and hearing the community talk about how many brain tumors there were, Ms. Lujan Grisham said in an interview. Kimberly, who died at the age of 21, continues to motivate the governor. If you're going to do something that hurts the citizens of my state, you've got to come through me, Ms. Lujan Grisham said. Earlier this month, the state scored a victory when the Air Force made concessions regarding a Clovis cleanup. It agreed to provide funding and technical resources for groundwater testing outside the military base, including at dairies, according to a joint statement released on May 12th by the Air Force and the State Environment Department. Yet the legal fight continues. The agreement will not affect New Mexico's lawsuit or the thousands of others nationwide. The federal government has to be accountable, right? It's got to happen at some point, Mr. Ogas said. That's what we're fighting for, at least. PFAS, the acronym, stands for perfluoroalkyl and polyfluoroalkyl substances, are not only forever, they're everywhere. Until recently, these synthetic compounds enjoyed widespread commercial and industrial use in takeout food containers, dental floss, drinking water, and water-resistant clothing. Studies have linked the substances to a wide variety of ailments in humans and animals, including heart disease, low birth weight, infertility, and cancers of the kidney, testicle, and breast. Though the risk and extent of health impacts from forever chemicals remain uncertain, the federal government and many states have set strict regulatory standards for PFAS in drinking water and food packaging. None of this is abstract for Mr. Schopp. After the killing of his cows, he and his workers spent 2 days hauling the carcasses into a pit on his property. 4 years have passed, but the mass grave at Highland Dairy is still a barren plot. Animal remains protrude from the mud, hide, a hoof, only weeds grow. Preliminary testing revealed that Mr. Schopp's well water had a concentration of 14,320 parts per trillion for PFOA and PFOS, two of the most ubiquitous forever chemicals, 205 times greater than the Environmental Protection Agency's recommended limit of 70 parts per trillion in drinking water. The base offered bottled water and filtration, but did nothing for the well water that was crucial to Highland Dairy and other farmers and ranchers near Clovis. By 2021, the PFAS concentration in one of Mr. Schopp's wells registered 37,733 parts per trillion. The following year, the EPA also issued much stricter recommendations for PFOA and PFOS. On May 14th, however, the agency indicated it intended to rescind the regulations and reconsider the regulatory determination for some other forever chemicals, including what are known as Gen X substances, angering activists. The corner of the base closest to Mr. Schopp is where the firefighters trained. As at most American military sites, Canon firefighters put out fires with aqueous film forming foam, or AFFFA, triple F as it's known, is exceptionally good at fighting fuel fires, which it does by creating a barrier against oxygen. It does so thanks to PFOS. One former Canon firefighter described incidents where firefighters would spray each other with the foam as a form of horseplay, and that they would spray the foam and allow visiting children to play in it, according to New Mexico's lawsuit. Firefighting foam now uses other forever chemicals thought to be somewhat less harmful than the ones that found their way into Mr. Schopp's water. The foam that percolated into the base's soil formed an underground plume that slowly spread southeast and now extends 4 to 6 miles from Cannon. It's not contained, said James Kenney, the Secretary of the State Environment Department, at a public meeting in Clovis last year. The horse got out of the barn. Mr. Schopp draws water from the Ogala Aquifer, which is in the path of the PFAS plume. Last summer, a state health department study found that people who lived or worked within the plume's area had blood concentrations of PFHXS, a common forever chemical more durable than PFOA and PFOS, 3 times higher than the national average. Mr. Schopp has his own lawsuit against the Pentagon. We're not letting them off the hook, he said. Military bases are PFAS hotspots. According to a report by the Government Accountability Office published last year, the Pentagon has identified 718 military installations where PFAS chemicals may have been released. Another Government Accountability Office report found that about 1,500 military facilities worldwide were still using AFFF to suppress fires, also Triple F, known as Triple F. A spokeswoman for the Air Force said the Department of Defense was committed to replacing AFFF with fluorine-free alternatives, referring to other formulations that do not contain PFAS. The spokeswoman also said that the Defense Department can meet its deadline for doing so October 1st. Then, in early May, New Mexico officials quietly traveled to Washington for a meeting at the Pentagon. They came away with what Mr. Ogas, the Environment Department's general counsel, described as a verbal agreement from the Air Force that it would pay for groundwater monitoring around Cannon, an important step in the cleanup process. The agreement resolves a practical matter for landowners like Mr. Schopp, but does nothing to address the deeper questions of responsibility, nor does it address contamination at other bases across New Mexico, like the one next to a lake animals drink from. If cows tell the story of Cannon, ducks tell the story of Holloman Air Force Base, a four-hour drive southwest. Lake Holloman, just outside the base, is a popular stop for migratory birds, including ducks. Designated an important bird area by the Audubon Society in 2002, it is a rare body of water next to the undulating expanse of White Sands National Park. But it is not a lake exactly. Created in 1965, the Holloman Evaporation Pond collects runoff from the base, including firefighting foam. Initially, swimming was forbidden, but not other recreation. Just as recently as a few months ago, people were camped next to it, Joseph Cook, a biologist at the University of New Mexico, said last year. Last summer, Dr. Cook and Jean-Luc Catron, a biologist at the University of New Mexico, and their colleagues published a study that found massive PFAS contamination around Lake Holloman. A dead killdeer chick collected on its shore had the highest PFAS concentration ever measured in a bird. According to Dr. Catron's calculations, a kangaroo rat found at the lake carried a PFOS burden 360 times that of Mr. Schopp's most contaminated cow. Dime-sized amounts of breast meat from waterfowl, Mr. Kennedy said at the public meeting in Clovis, can have a lifetime exposure of PFAS. Public access to Lake Holloman was terminated around the time the study was published. Today, the lake is a flat blue expanse ringed by chain-link fencing. The only sign of human life is the roar of F-16 fighting falcons taking off and banking over the Sacramento Mountains. Birds land on the lake. Bigger animals drink its water. Then they disperse across the state. The town of Santa Rosa in eastern New Mexico is 200 miles from Lake Holloman, but migratory birds and animals easily traverse those distances. To understand how PFAS is spreading through waterfowl, Matthew Monjarras, who founded Impact Outdoors, a nonprofit that conducts environmental programs, including hunting trips for veterans, and Christopher Witt, a bird biologist at the University of New Mexico, set out into a series of wetlands outside Santa Rosa called Tres Lagunas. In the pre-dawn darkness, the men parked, loaded shotguns, and moved in silence through the snake-infested grass of Tres Lagunas. They waded into cold water, which quickly reached their waists. Then they stood waiting as pink bands of light appeared in the sky. Mr. Monjarras used duck calls to produce a series of convincing quacks. Ducks answered the call. Shots rang out. Birds fell into the water. After the hunt, Dr. Witt dissected each bird, shaving off liver samples to be tested as part of a statewide survey. PFAS tend to concentrate in liver tissue. Mr. Monjarras estimates he has eaten dozens of duck livers. He has grown so concerned that he drove 3 hours to the meeting in Clovis. Carter Monjarras, his 5-year-old son, wearing hunting camouflage, tagged along. As the presentation was concluding, Mr. Manjarras asked about the game he and his family consume. How do I guarantee that I'm not inviting PFAS to my dinner table? I would personally choose not to eat wild game that was hunted around Holloman, Mr. Kenny answered delicately. But he also acknowledged the impossible position Mr. Manjarras and others were in, having to guess the toxic exposure of every bird they hunted. That should never have happened, Mr. Kenny said. And now, a question and answer from the New York Times bestseller book of General Ignorance, Everything You Think You Know Is Wrong, by John Lloyd and John Mitchinson. The question is, did cannibals cook their victims whole in large pots? Producing a watertight metal pot large enough to hold a person requires industrial technology that was new, even to the West, in the 19th century. In reality, you were much more likely to be butchered and roasted in small joints, or else smoked and salted for snacking on later. The word cannibal comes from a misrecording of the name for this Central American Carib tribe by Columbus in 1495. He reported finding a recently abandoned canib feast of human limbs simmering in small cauldrons and roasting on spits. Other explorers reported cannibalism in South America, Africa, Australia, New Guinea, and throughout the Pacific. Captain Cook was in no doubt that the Maori ate enemies taken in battle. During his second voyage, his lieutenant, Charles Clerk, grilled a portion of head at the behest of a Maori warrior and records that he devoured it most ravenously and sucked his fingers half a dozen times over in rapture. William Aron's influential The Man-Eating Myth, 1979, argued that these stories were racist lies invented to justify Western colonialism. It resulted in a period of cannibal denial among anthropologists. However, more recent discoveries have led most historians and anthropologists to accept that cannibalism was practiced by many tribal cultures, mostly for ritual purposes, sometimes for food. The last society to admit to ritual cannibalism, the Foray tribe of New Guinea, stopped in the mid-1950s after an outbreak of Kuru, a brain disease contracted through eating human brain and spinal tissue. There is also archaeological evidence. Collections of butchered human remains have even been found in France, Spain, and Britain. Some of the British remains date from 30 BC to AD 130, suggesting that the Romans' belief that the ancient Britons ate people was justified. In October 2003, the inhabitants of a Fijian village announced that they would be making a formal apology to the family of the Reverend Thomas Baker, an English missionary killed and eaten by their ancestors in 1867. They'd even tried to eat his boots, but those proved too tough and were returned to the Methodist Church in 1993. And our final question, what do you get if you suck your pencil? Nothing bad apart from being told not to. Pencils don't contain lead and never have. They contain graphite, one of the six pure forms of carbon, which is no more poisonous than the wood it's wrapped in. Even the paint is now lead-free. The confusion comes from the fact that sharpened lead was used for more than 2,000 years to draw on papyrus and paper. The only deposit of pure solid graphite ever found was uncovered by accident in Borrowdale, Cumbria, in 1564. It was protected by strict laws and armed guards and mined for just 6 weeks a year. The so-called black lead it produced was cut into thin square sticks to make the first pencils. English pencils were adopted quickly across Europe. The first recorded use was by the Swiss naturalist Conrad Gessner in 1565. Henry David Thoreau, author of Walden, was the first American to successfully fire graphite with clay to make a pencil lead But the big commercial breakthrough came in 1827 when Joseph Dixon of Salem, Massachusetts, introduced a machine that mass-produced square graphic pencils at the rate of 132 a minute. By the time he died in 1869, the Joseph Dixon Crucible Company was the world leader, producing 86,000 round-cased pencils a day. Today, now called Dixon Ticonderoga, it is still one of the world's leading pencil makers. Roald Dahl wrote all his books using a yellow Dixon Ticonderoga medium pencil. The traditional yellow pencil goes back to 1890 when Joseph Hardmuth manufactured the first one at his Prague factory and named it after Queen Victoria's famous yellow diamond, Koh-i-Noor. She'd called his luxury line the Koh-i-Noor of pencils. Other manufacturers copied it. In North America, 75% of all pencils sold are yellow. The average pencil can be sharpened 17 times and can write 45,000 words or a straight line 35 miles long. The rubber attached to the end of a pencil is held in place by a device known as a ferrule. The patent was first granted in 1858, but they were unpopular in schools because teachers believed they encouraged laziness. The rubber in most pencils is actually made from vegetable oil, with a very small amount of rubber binding it together. Before we close, just a reminder that coming up at 7 p.m. is Telegram and Gazette. At 8 p.m., USA Today. At 9, the Boston Globe. At 10 p.m., the Backyard Bookshelf Archives. The same is true at 11 p.m., the Backyard Bookshelf Archives. You have been listening to Science Journal, a production of Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. If you would like a hard copy of our program schedule, either in large print or braille, please call us at 508-797-1117. Archived editions of this program are available on our website, audiojournal.org, or go to the Audio Journal app on your iPhone, iPad, or Android device. If you have an idea for a topic to explore, please contact Audio Journal at 508-797-1117 or email us at info@audiojournal.org. I'm Tricia Droney. Thanks so much for listening this afternoon.
Listen to Audio Journal on your smart speaker. Just say, Alexa, play radio station Audio Journal on TuneIn. Or, hey Google, play radio station Audio Journal on TuneIn.
What's your vision?
People with disabilities adapt on a daily basis. They're people you want on your team. And we're here to help you find blind and visually impaired professionals to help you reach your organizational goals. Building an inclusive workforce where individuals with disabilities are welcome is possible thanks to Mass Commission for the Blind. Partner with them to hire individuals who are blind or visually impaired and reach your workforce goals. The success of your organization depends on the diversity of your team. Call 1-800-392-6450 or visit mass.gov/MCB to learn how you can become an employer partner for the blindness community. That's 1-800-392-6450 or mass.gov/MCB.
What's your vision?